Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
My favorite thing about working in healthcare is the people. This industry brings together brilliant, highly motivated individuals who are driven by the opportunity to make a difference. My name is Hallie Tecco, and this is The Heart of Healthcare, a podcast where I'll be introducing you to the people on the ground moving the needle in public health and medicine. Today, I'm excited to introduce you to Dr. Farzad Mostashari, who has spent his career at the forefront of healthcare policy and health technology. He is currently the co-founder and CEO of Allidaid, which helps independent primary care practices deliver better care at lower cost through a physician-led ACO model and value-based care solutions. Farzad is the former National Coordinator for Health IT at HHS, and he served as a distinguished expert at the Brookings Institute Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform. Prior to his work at the Office of the National Coordinator, he founded the New York City Primary Care Information Project, which equipped 1,500 physicians in underserved communities with electronic health records. He has been published in the New York Times, the Journal of American Medical Association, and Health Affairs, among others. Dr. Mostashari received his MD from Yale and his Master's in Population Health from Harvard's School of Public Health. Dr. Mostashari, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with talking about primary care. A JAMA article found that the number of Americans with a primary care physician is actually declining, especially for those who are younger, less medically complex, non-white, or living in the South. What do you make of this?
Yeah, we have a primary care shortage. We have, relative to other countries, we have a lot more specialists and a lot fewer primary care docs. And at the end of the day, I think that has a lot to do with our payment system and the just how yeah. differently compensated primary care is. We'll get to that, I'm sure, today.
Yeah.
But you know, the problem isn't just limited to the young and the healthy, where you might argue, well, do they really need an ongoing longitudinal relationship with someone to quarterback their care? Something like 30% of all Medicare beneficiaries don't have a stable relationship with primary care practice. And, you know, those seniors definitely need and research has shown would benefit from having that relationship.
Interesting. So it's not just a supply issue, it's a demand issue.
Well, I think in many cases it is. The lack of primary care capacity, and particularly in professional shortage areas, whether yeah. it's urban areas or rural areas, that definitely is part of the issue. But yeah, I think there is something also in that the concept of you have your family doctor is under pressure now from, you know, you can't walk by a strip mall and not see, you know, a convenience care place, and pharmacies are now saying we do primary care, and your phone says it does primary care, and your health plan says they want to, you know, give you a virtual primary care first experience.
Yeah.
So I do think that kind of having a place that you associate with, the place you're going to go to again and again to coordinate your care, is under pressure.
Yeah. And so the number of medical students who are going into primary care, the fact that that's been declining and more going into specialties, is that a salary issue? Is that just, it's not as appealing because of all these new technologies that are trying to replace the primary care relationship?
I don't think it's a technology issue. I don't think it's a, you know, intellectual issue in many ways. If you think about it, it's much, much, much harder to be a primary care physician and stay up to date on what's going on than it is to be a, you know, thyroid surgeon or something. It's hard. It's hard work. And it's not as well compensated. And that, I think, creates this trickle down where it changes perceptions and it changes the sense of, you know, well, if you're really smart, then, you know, you'd go into dermatology, anesthesiology, radiology, whatever. So, I do think that you can't ignore just the economics of it, that primary care is the lowest paid of all the different specialties.
And pediatrics is part of that.
It is.
It's in a bucket, yeah.
You know, what's interesting is actually geriatrics, which is primary care for old people,
yeah,
is the only fellowship where you earn less money if you do a fellowship than if you don't.
Why is that?
Because geriatricians are paid so poorly. And they're the people that we need the most.
Yeah, where the bulk of the healthcare spending is.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. So why is it important to keep physicians independent, specifically primary care physicians?
I think for us, you know, people ask, like, what does it mean independent? You know, like you mean like they're not an employee? And they're like, no, most physicians don't have a shingle with their own name on it, right? Oftentimes they work, actually the most common thing is to work for another physician. What we mean by independent is the ability to act in the patient's best interest, what you think is in the patient's best interest, free from kind of corporate objectives. And that corporation could be a nonprofit hospital, right? So, and in many cases,
not so not profit hospital though.
Yeah, not so a retained earnings hospital, yes. A tax advantaged hospital.
Yes.
So that's what we mean by independent, in particularly in the context of value based care, where you know you want to be sure that the physicians really are thinking about what's best for the patient. How do I keep the patient out of the hospital? How do I reduce unnecessary suffering and unnecessary cost? And sometimes those are at odds with what the CFO of the hospital wants you to do. And I actually think that's a big part of the burnout that we're seeing, which I think is a whole other podcast, but is when the physicians feel that the duty they owe their employer is different from the duty they owe the patient. Mm. And that's what I mean by independent, is when you don't have that misalignment.
Yeah. And has COVID worsened this burnout? I know that's another podcast, but I'm just...
Oh my gosh.
we have to address it.
Yeah, no, it has absolutely increased the burnout, in part because, you know, our mantra is good for patients, good for doctors, good for society. And when you have misalignment, when you as a physician feel like what the duty I owe society and, you know, what I think is best for the patient, that and like I'm at odds with the patient, like that is the worst, right? At a time initially... when, you know, we couldn't find PPE and people and physicians and nurses were getting infected and sick. And remember those early days, like everyone was talking about these healthcare heroes, right? And then the politicization of vaccine recommendations and mask protocols, those made it even worse because now you have, and we see this, we had one of our physicians who was the National Rural Healthcare Association Physician of the Year in Kansas, who'd lived in this community all her life, became the target of people, you know, mad at her and screaming at her because they perceived that, you know, she was somehow a tool for, you know, whatever. And that's what rips, and that's what is causing, I think, more burnout than anything else. It's the switch from being aligned with your patients to sometimes feeling that the patients are really not aligned with what you know is best for them and best for society.
Yeah, it's almost like this additional emotional labor that physicians, nurses, anyone really working patient-facing roles has had to face over the last few years.
Particularly primary care. Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. And so a lot of people say that we have a physician shortage because our actual number of physicians per capita is lower than other countries. Do you think that this is a problem that we can solve?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's not just physicians, though, but primary care capacity is about a whole team, right? And it may be harder to ramp up capacity on the primary care physician workforce. Although that can happen, I think if, you know, primary care paid like urology, you'd see a lot more primary care docs. but also the ability to recruit and retain all the staffing around it to increase the capacity, to increase the effectiveness. We have a lot of primary care physicians who aren't, you know, who are doing a lot of manual work, who are doing a lot of the work that others on their team could be helping support them for, but they don't have the money to pay, a nurse, so, or two nurses or three nurses. So they're having to do it all themselves. And so that, I think, is part of the solution.
Yeah. Okay. So you are a known advocate for value-based care. Can you explain to our listeners what this means?
Value-based care, to me, the simplest explanation is if in your business model, it is more profitable to prevent strokes than to treat strokes, you're doing value-based care. So right now, the reason why we have a lot of stroke centers, we have a lot of neuro ICUs, we have a lot of companies making electric wheelchairs, is because we wait until people have strokes and then we will pour any amount of money into treating that stroke. But we control blood pressure 2/3 of the time. Not because it's hard to control blood pressure, but because, frankly, organizations don't have the incentives, the profits from preventing strokes. If you paid as much for a stroke as you did for preventing a stroke as you did for treating a stroke, you would see a very different set of activities come to the fore. And that's what value-based care is. It's saying that there should be economic incentives around things not happening, suffering not happening, hospitalizations not happening.
Okay, so I have to point out how your voice just started glowing when you were talking about this. This is clearly something that, I think for a lot of us, it's maddening that we've built this fee-for-service industry that has had perverse incentives for everyone. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about how we got to the point of fee-for-service, how we can change that, and how it is currently being changed?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's understandable in a way, right? Like you fix my car, I pay you, right? You do something, like you give me a service, pay me by the hour, right? And the challenge with, we can all understand the beauty of paying for strokes that didn't happen, but what you need is you need pretty sophisticated, I think, data and analytics and business frameworks to have a sense of the counterfactual, like compared to what? If strokes go down, compared to what? It's the compared to what that has been hard to figure out exactly how we can all agree. And by the most important people to agree here are the payers and the providers, right? That this is how much it should have cost. This is what the benchmark or budget should have been. And this is what it actually was. And so we can agree on what the value that was created in the middle was. Yeah. And that has been the work literally of 20 years of work to create different payment models that can be agreed upon by all sides that are fair and sustainable. And so that to me was like the most exciting part in 2014 when the accountable care organizations were really becoming part of the permanent program in Medicare, and they were being iterated and the policies were being said. It was like, oh my gosh, this is now finally, there is a viable way to create a business in value-based care.
Yeah. And the patients win too. No one wants to get a stroke.
Exactly.
We'd all prefer to stay healthy.
Very much so.
Yeah. So is this world more possible now because of technological advancements over the last decade?
Yeah, we met first when I was, I think, national coordinator for health IT.
Yep.
And we were on this mission to enable, the reason why I was doing it was I was a public health guy, was to have better control of blood pressure and fewer medical errors and better communication. And we successfully got American healthcare off of paper and pen onto computers. And blood pressure control didn't change.
Did you expect it to improve?
Well, 100% I did. Yeah. So that was, I had a profound feeling of disillusionment that technology was going to be the answer. But at the same time, it's no accident that there are a whole host of companies that do kind of what Aledade does, and we call them fellow travelers, that are doing physician enablement, value-based care, that they all started around somewhere between 2012 to 2015, right? Why? Because finally, there is a technology infrastructure that you can use to match up that clinical data with the claims data, to do predictive models, to have workflows that can be replicated in diverse practices on that operating system of a new technology foundation. So technology is essential, and it is the difference maker. I'll tell a personal story. My father-in-law, who passed away last Thanksgiving, was an amazing guy, physician, who started one of the first staff model HMOs in the United States in the 70s in New Hampshire. And he was called at the time a communist for, having this different payment model, right? Where they had the right incentives, right? And they employed physicians. And when I started the company, and then he went on to become dean of Tufts Medical School and head of Tufts Health Plan and so forth. Amazing guy. But I started the company and I had been a government bureaucrat as long as he'd known me, married to his daughter, right? And I said to him, "Papa, I'm going to start a business." And he said, "Oh, really? What's the business going to do?" And I said, "Oh, we're going to take risk. And if we reduce costs, we get to keep some of it with the primary care docs." And he looked at me and he said, "So far as that, how is this different than what we did 50 years ago?" I said, "Well, it's not that different." But then I showed him our tech stack, and I could just see the tension draining away from him when he was like, "Oh, this is why it's different." Mm-hmm. It's not different in the purpose. It's not different in the economics. Yeah. What's different is that you actually have technology that can help the scale.
Yeah. I feel like HMO's got a bad rap for kind of being this gatekeeper.
Yeah, because there wasn't that many ways that primary care could reduce costs, and they did the easy way, at least in the public perception, of like their job is to give people less, not more. Yeah. And for us, it has been a real mantra: is patients have to feel like they're getting more, not less. They're getting concierge primary care. They're getting more accessible primary care. They're getting more available primary care. They're getting more informed primary care, more engaged primary care, more aligned primary care. They're getting more, not less.
Yeah. And do they feel that?
Yeah.
They're getting that.
Yeah. Plus 92 net promoter scores from patients towards our practices.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after the break.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way?
maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And so the way that the capitation model works, I don't know if you like that word. It's technically capitation, though.
It's fine. I mean, capitation is one flavor of the overall picture. That you can have risk-based contracts, global risk contracts, total cost of care contracts, shared risk contracts, whatever, full risk contracts. It's all the same. It's basically, you have a budget and cost for all the costs of the patient, right?
Yeah.
And including the hospitalizations, which is the single most expensive source of suffering in the system. And if costs go down below what that expected is, you get to keep all or some of it.
Okay. Yeah. We learned the capitation model when I was in my MPH program. And so rewarding physicians for keeping patients healthy is a big tenet of that. How exactly are they rewarded?
So say we have a cohort of 100 practices at Aledade, right? We get the practices together. We get these as many of the health plans for their patients as we can to agree to this framework, right? If costs go down, you get to share. We get to share in it. So they might have $1.5 billion of spending for their patients. 100 primary care doctors.
That's an insane amount.
That's just an insane amount of money, right?
Yeah.
You get 100 primary care docs, these, people scrapping, right?
Yeah.
And their patients could have easily $1.5 billion of spending. If you reduce that spending by 10%, which is what we've now done in, by year four of working on this, we just reduced all-cause hospitalizations by 15%, total spending down 10% compared to budget. That's $150 million. And then you say to the health plan, okay, you get to keep some of this, right? So like maybe the health plan keeps $50 million because so that they can reduce premiums and they can get some benefit.
Yeah, they've taken on the financial risk.
Yeah, they take on some of the risk, but most of the financial risk is now shared with the provider groups. And that leaves $100 million, right? And that $100 million is what goes back to the practices and it pays for us, who are the enablers of the contracts, the technology, the playbook, and so forth.
Yeah. So you told us that, you had this career arc from government, maybe communist, I don't know.
Very much so.
you now run a company that I believe made $300 million last year. Pretty successful company. Tell us about kind of that transition from being in what you think of as kind of slow moving bureaucratic environment to fast paced tech company that requires a ton of collaboration across multiple stakeholders.
Yeah. I mean, my government experience was probably not typical of what people at least think about. We did, when I was in the New York City Health Department for 10 years, we did the primary care information project, which, went from nothing to, 1,500 physicians. We then was at the Office of the National Coordinator, which went from 30 employees to, just being setting the rules for $30 billion to be dispersed and $1 billion and 60 nonprofits in every state. And, I was in these very atypical things where it really did feel very startup-y. So for me, it didn't feel that different. Honestly, it's like the skills are kind of the same. You got to be able to create a very concrete vision of the future. You got to motivate people toward that vision. And then you got to create a belief that unlikely future is not only possible, but inevitable. And then lay the strategy for how to make that happen. The one difference I will say is it was a lot less stressful to run a startup than it was to run a federal agency.
Seriously?
And so, oh my gosh. Yes.
Interesting.
It's, you look at these people who take those top jobs and the average tenure is probably 2 years because it's just so exhausting.
That says a lot about that. I haven't worked in government, but I've worked in startups, and it is very stressful at a startup. So
not as stressful as running a federal agency.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. So we all face naysayers in healthcare. Can you share a story about a roadblock that you faced in your work, your current work?
Yeah. So I had the wrong mental model, and mental models are really important. And my mental model of healthcare costs was that it's a super saturated cloth. Like every, you know, this fee-for-service system has created just like this incredible excess of costs compared to other systems. And this is the important part. My mental model was, if we give that super saturated wet cloth half a twist, tons of money is going to pour out. Mm. And it turned out that in our first year's experience with this accountable care organizations in four states, we reduced all-cause hospitalizations by 7%, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. And costs went up.
Uh-oh.
Because the hospitals, seeing that they're earning less revenue, increased their coding, particularly for sepsis.
Wow.
And they got paid, instead of, you know, $5,000 for a UTI or normal pneumonia admission, they got paid $11,000 for a sepsis admission.
Wow.
And it was my realization then that, it's healthcare is not a super saturated cloth waiting for you to give it half a twist and pour out all the money. It's a bunch of goblins holding on to gold coins. And you have to pry their fingers off the coin, and then you turn around and they've grabbed another coin. So every dollar of waste is someone's, you know, revenue based on suffering.
Yeah. Do you think systematically there is someone at the hospital who is looking at their billing? And so they were like informing their doctors to rethink billing. Wow.
Yeah, it's called CDI, clinical documentation improvement.
There's a name for it.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways,
it's a strategy. Did McKinsey come up with it for them?
Yeah, I'm sure. And it's and you know, like what helped them do it was EHRs too.
Yeah. So the length of stay, did that, I assume that had that decreased. So they had fewer nights from your patients under your care.
Well, yeah. The key thing for us is to prevent the hospitalization in the first place. Mm-hmm. Once they're in the hospital, it's very hard to control what happens in the hospital.
And how do you do that with patients other than
prevention?
Tangibly, okay. Prevention, but like, what is that? Is it catching things earlier? Is it changing behaviors? Like, what exactly can is it telling them, hey, if you think you need to go to the ER, call me first? Like, what are the actual
steps for prevention? Oh my gosh, you're a great marketer, because after 4 years, we devised that slogan, call me first.
Seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. So we do, we've had to kind of shrink the change, right? And script the moves for these practices, because it can be overwhelming. Like, you want me to control total cost of care, but I don't control everything. And so what do you want me to exactly do? And so there's four things. The first thing is, one visit a year should be just to sit and talk about what's going to get you in trouble and what can we do today to...
For how long? More than 15 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. these are longer visits. And there's like, you know, 13 different quality things that we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk, right? We're going to go through this template of a preventive visit. We call this the annual well visit for seniors. That's the first piece of it. And we found is that one of those visits prevents $500 in cost over the next 11 months. So that's great.
Yeah.
And it's free to the patient.
Great.
The second is, when the patient is there sitting in front of you for another visit, they came in because they have a headache, they came in because whatever, to be informed about what's going on in that patient's life outside of the four walls of the primary care office. So we will tell the physician at the point of care, when the patient has come in for any visit, we will say, you know, they're not filling their prescription, right? Hmm. right? And they're like, oh no, I did not know that, in fact. Right?
How would they know that? Yeah.
Right. How would they know that? We get the claims data and the pharmacy data, and we do the analytics, and we present it to them right at the point of care, right? We say to them, oh, do you know all the specialists this patient is seeing? Because here's the list of all the specialists and when the last time was they saw them and what they saw them for. And the primary care doc's like, no, in fact, I did not know that, right? Did you know that they went to the emergency room 2 weeks ago? No, I did not know that, right? So it's arming the primary care docs with information from across the ecosystem and making it tangible insights into what are the highest priority things for this patient at the point of care. And then there's two other things, which is what you alluded to. Every time one of your patients, one of your flock goes to the emergency room, you should not only know about it, you should not only care about it, you should do something about it. And for us, it's reconnect with the patient and see what's going on and see if you can help keep them healthy and from going back to the emergency room, which is the gateway to the hospitalization. And so, you know, there's a lot of obviously technology underpinning that of like real-time event notifications and pulling data from HIEs and ADT feeds and blah, 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 right? But at the end of the day, it's in the doctor's office. There's now a new workflow, which is boot up the computer and go to the work list every day of the people who were in the emergency room yesterday and give them a call and check in with them. That is hugely powerful, in part because of the message it sends the patient that there's somebody who cares and someone who's watching. And if I go to the emergency room for something that I could have gone to the primary care office for, they're going to call me. Yeah. And they're going to say, did you know that our offices have, you know, same day appointments? Did you know that, you know, do you know our number? Call me first.
Yeah.
And so that change in mentality and change in habits is, I think, a big part of it. But it all starts with prevention, honestly.
Mm-hmm. So on the prevention side, are there lifestyle behavior change, anything from smoking, eating, physical activity that these physicians can support, whether it's referring out to different programs?
Yeah. So what we then have them do is primary care. So instead of me trying to tell a primary care doc who's put their 10,000 hours in how to primary care, I'm like, listen, you're the expert here. You figure out what this person is going to respond to the most and how to talk to them about whether it's behavior change or taking their medications or, you know, some other service. So I think that is, you know, Atul Gawande came to see us and we described what we're doing. He said, we talked about how we're improving blood pressure control. And he said, so you must have very specific medication escalation protocols. I said, no, we don't. We just tell the primary care docs, like, do what you know. Mm-hmm. We're just highlighting that they should pay attention to blood pressure control. We're not telling them how to do it.
Yeah. And then over the last 2 years, I imagine a big conversation that these PCPs are having is around the vaccine.
Yeah.
Because that ultimately is going to keep their patients out of the hospital. We know hospitalizations and vaccine rates are related.
Exactly.
What are you seeing in it? Is that different in rural conservative communities versus your doctors that are practicing in more progressive communities? Did that impact their bottom line last year?
For sure. But I will say the vaccine distribution didn't really emphasize primary care when it could have, should have. When there was a scarcity of vaccine supply, states and the federal government prioritized max vaccination sites and pharmacies.
Mm.
And I think that was a mistake. And I said so at the time.
Yeah.
I think you could have anticipated that vaccine supply was going to ease and the problem was going to then switch not to, you know, people needing to get the people who can get Whole Foods online delivery slots getting vaccines, but the more resistant, right, who need a conversation with their primary care doc.
Absolutely.
And we did not condition people to say, you know, where you're going to get the vaccine is from your primary care doc. Go talk to them, right?
Yeah.
So that I think was
an
unforced error. But there's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful YouTube video from one of our you know, docs, Jen Brule in Kansas, where she talks about how she patiently talks to her patients who are hesitant about the vaccine. They're not anti-vaxxers. They're just hesitant. And they've heard a lot of, you know, things that aren't necessarily true. And she just steadily, patiently works with them, just as she would work with someone with high blood pressure who's, you know, still having a lot of salt. Mm-hmm. It's not a one and done conversation. It's a conversation that builds on the trust that you've built with them over a prolonged period of time. That's primary care. That's what it is.
Yeah. I love that. It's too bad that I get my flu shot at my primary care visit every year. Mm-hmm. It would make sense to have, you know, all the vaccines there.
And for minority populations, that's even more true, that they tend to get their flu shots more from their primary care practices than from mass vaccination sites or pharmacies.
Yeah. So on that topic, on serving folks who have traditionally, historically been underserved and marginalized, how do you think value-based care enables more equitable care for poor rural communities?
Yeah. I used to think that that if we just focus on the patients who need it the most, the sickest patients, that we would automatically address health equity. And after George Floyd, we did a reckoning internally and we said, well, is that true? Because we'd never actually looked at it. And what we found was that we do a very good job of having equity in terms of our processes. We do preventive visits. We call patients for preventive visits just as much, regardless of their race, ethnicity. We, you know, call them after an emergency room visit just as much within any given practice. There's no discrimination at the practice level. And yet, systemically, blood pressure is higher in our African-American patients and our white patients. And if you look at severely out of control blood pressure, 160 over 100, the thing that's going to cause a stroke, it's 8% among our Black patients across 38 states and 4% among our white patients.
Wow.
So we said, you know, value-based care sets the predicate for a whole series of competencies and capabilities that you need to be able to look at the data, to be able to reach out to patients, to be able to prioritize, to be able to highlight, right? It creates all those capabilities, but you don't automatically address health equity unless you address health equity specifically. And so we set it as a separate objective for our company objectives and our executive compensation and bonuses and our kind of OKRs for the whole company was reducing severely uncontrolled blood pressure among Black patients.
Wow. Are there other programs that you guys are considering or have done around cultural competency?
Yeah. We try to really weave it into everything that we do, okay. But that to me is more on the process side, right? And I'm saying if this is an outcomes game where at the end of the day, like you want to say like, did you reduce hospitalizations or didn't you? You know, did costs go down or did you make a good effort, right? It's not like we have to look at those outcomes.
Yeah. You focus on the destination and those providers can figure it out. But are they, I'm sure some of them have figured out best practices. For instance, I know I've seen the research that Black women are less likely to be addressed when they have pain issues than white counterparts. How are we able to kind of disseminate this sort of information so that there's awareness?
Yeah. Well, and I think this is where technology can be something that pours into concrete or makes even more opaque existing biases. And I'm talking about machine learning and artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. Or it can be something to help actually address those and equalize those biases. So we had this really, really, really interesting, I don't do you have time for a little diversion into AI health equity?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So we give lists of things to do, right, for the practices. And one of the lists was people who have become disengaged from primary care, call them and pull them back in, right?
How do you define disengaged?
Like they haven't had a visit with you for the past 9 months.
Okay. Got it.
And then, you know, we have some other kind of machine learning estimates of, and they are likely to get into trouble, right? They actually need primary care. So we make a list, and then we say, okay, how did it work? And it turns out that there are some patients who, if you put them on the list, you're more likely for the practice to successfully reach them and get them to come back in. And so if the question is, and this is so much of MLAI kind of analytics, is about what's the question you're asking the machine, right? The question we asked at first was, well, if we wanted to prioritize this list so that, you know, if the practice can only call 10 patients, they should call the 10 patients who will give you the highest yield in terms of successfully having a successful outcome, which is like the patient comes in for a visit. Mm-hmm. That makes sense, right, Hallie?
Yeah.
Right? Well, we did that. We found a model that actually does a bang up job of predicting that. And before we actually put it into practice, though, one of our analysts said we should look at the racial breakdown.
It was all white, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It turned out that 15% of the list overall were Black patients, which is similar to our overall group. But among the prioritized group of people who are most likely to respond, 8% Black. It's just looking at the world as it is. And it's saying, well, you know what? Given your current approaches, when our practices call their Black patients, on average, right, they're less likely to get us. Maybe it's because they don't pick up the phone. Maybe it's because, you know, the conversation you had with them didn't work. Maybe it's because there's not the right contact information, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
But the end result is if we just follow the machine, we would worsen those. That is the definition of systemic racism, right? And we would have worsened it. So instead, we're asking a different question now. What are the practices who do a really bang-up job of having successful outreach with their Black patients? Can we identify those practices and have essentially an anti-racist algorithm where we try to change the intervention that's happening in order to make it more successful in reaching those populations?
And have you found that Black patients are more likely to engage if they have a Black physician?
That is definitely what the research shows.
We
don't have the race ethnicity of our of not just the physicians, but the nurses and the person calling on the phone, right? Which I'm sure is a big part of it. But what we have done is intensified our outreach to minority-owned practices. Mm. And we've created what we call this Mosaic Pod, which has been, you know, very well received. And I think part of the thing is always, like, you just have to reach out, right? Like, we were reaching out through the existing networks of the practices we'd gotten first. And so we weren't reaching those minority-owned practices. Sure. And then when we reached out, guess what? A lot of them wanted to sign up. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, of course. So what's next for you and Allidaid?
So the big thing that we are doing is thinking about what are the wraparound services that could help our practices succeed even more. So the heart of value-based care is primary care, but a primary care office can't, in the time, in the hours in the day that they have, address all of the needs of their, particularly their most complex patients. And so what we're thinking hard about is, what are some services that we can help wrap around our practices that would address those needs? So I'll give you an example. There are, you know, as part of that wellness conversation that I mentioned, like, part of it is, what are your preferences and wishes for, you know, in terms of end of life care? What are some different scenarios, and what matters to you, right? But there's some patients who it's just super complex. They have a touch of dementia, or they have disabilities that are complex. They have a complex family situation. They just need a lot of conversation. And they may be, in fact, in the last year of life, that, like, they may be more likely to actually face these questions. And so that's the scenario where as a primary care doc, you're like, gosh, like I just don't have 3 hours to like speak exhaustively to the patient and then call in their daughter in California and then bring their son from New York in on the same phone call. And then we can all have the discussion. We can video the discussion and then we can go through a bunch of scenarios, right? But there happens to be a service that does this that we had engaged with. And we actually did a randomized clinical trial where we cut the list. We prioritized the patients. We gave them only half the list. And then we compared outcomes for the folks who got the service versus who didn't. And we found a big reduction in hospitalizations, particularly those patients who were prioritized appropriately. And so we went out and we bought the company. It's an advanced care planning company called Iris. And we said, we want this to become available to all of our highest risk, most complex patients. And so that is the first piece of what we're calling Aledade Care Solutions, which are going to be services, as I mentioned, that are going to wrap around our practices and their patients to be able to help, you know, do more stuff that's good for the patient, good for the doctor, and good for society.
Very cool. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Mostashari, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
This is Hallie Tecco with the Heart of Healthcare podcast. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's discussion, subscribe and leave us a review. Have an idea for a future episode? Share it with us at heartofhealthcarepodcast.com.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Heart of Healthcare. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on social, and tell all your friends to listen. The Heart of Healthcare is a product of Offscript Health. We are a healthcare engagement company built for patients and caregivers by patients and caregivers. Our executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Andrew McDowell. Our senior producer is Brianna Seely. Our host is Hallie Tecco. It is recorded, mixed, and edited by Brianna Seely. For advertising and media inquiries, email media@offscript.com. That's media@offscript.com. For more information, visit offscript.com.